Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Will you join me in a moment of silence as we remember soldiers and civilians killed and injured during war? Thank you. Good evening. My name is Kimberly Cronick. I'm Director of Community Content and Engagement at WILL and Illinois Public Media. We're here to learn about the changing military from those who served and those who were willing to share their stories, and to recognize the Uni High students and their teacher, Janet Morford, who spent more than 2 years listening to stories from those veterans and turning them into content that you may have heard on WILL radio this past few weeks. Tonight, you'll have a chance to listen to part of the students' work, to share your own stories, and to ask questions of the panel you see before you. The panel includes people from the students' work and from elsewhere. We're going to record the panel and audience discussion, and I'll assume that if you speak, that you don't mind being recorded. I'm going to pass around a handheld microphone. If you want to speak, just raise your hand and I'll get it to you. Just a quick ground rule here. Please be respectful, and when you ask your question, make it brief and then hand the microphone back to me. And if you didn't hear the full length or the radio series the students created, you can do so by going to WILL's website, will.illinois.edu. I want to just also let you know we have to be out of here by 9, so we're going to stop the discussion at 8:10. At 8:10, we will stop, and Mike will pack up, and you can still mingle, but the formal presentation will end at 8:10. Next, it's my pleasure to introduce Janet Morford, who's social studies teacher at Uni High, and faculty advisor to the students who created tonight's program. And before she grabs the mic, I just want to say that we do appreciate very much the 20-year relationship that WIL has had with Uni High. Dave Dickey, who couldn't be here tonight, he's at the National Farm Association Broadcasters Conference, has mentored students from Uni High for almost all of those 20 years, and we thank him. And now, Janet Morford.
So thank you all for being here today as we celebrate the completion of our newest oral history radio documentary, From the Front Lines to the Home Front, Inside Views of the Military, 1940 to 2012. I'm Janet Morford. I teach social studies at Uni High, and I am really fortunate to be the faculty advisor to these wonderful students who design and carry out each of our annual oral history projects. I work closely with colleagues at Illinois Public Media, including Dave Dickey, who oversees the production of the radio pieces that result from each project, and Kimberly Cronick. For 20 years now, we have been doing oral history as part of a unique partnership between Uni High and WILL AM 580 radio station. This partnership was begun in 1993 by Barb Wysocki, who was then the head of the Social Studies Department at Uni, and Dan Simeone, who was then station manager of WILL. And since Barb is here, I'd just like to ask her to stand. And all you students, look at the person who started this whole thing for us. And very interestingly, Dan Simeone's wife, Melody, was one of our interviewees for this project, but they unfortunately had a conflict and weren't able to join us this evening. While the people involved have changed over time, the basic idea remains the same. Each class of Uni eighth graders studies the history of a particular topic or issue in social studies class. Then they prepare for and conduct oral history interviews with people from our local community who have firsthand experience or knowledge of that topic. Students who are interested in the next phase then apply and are chosen to serve as production interns, or WILL interns, as we call them. This small team of students work outside of class to turn the 20 or 30 hours of recorded testimony into a one-hour radio documentary, and in recent years, they have also produced a series of short radio pieces which are broadcast on WILL. While that's the project in a nutshell, it involves so much work and such a long-term commitment on the part of the students who have chosen to do this work that we have come to feel that it's highly appropriate to have some public moment of celebration to honor their efforts. So thank you all for being here today, in part, to provide the public recognition that our WILL interns richly deserve. We're also here today to honor and celebrate the other group of people without whom we would not be able to even do oral history. And for this project, these are the 18 members of the community who agreed to be interviewed for this project, either because they themselves served in the military at some point between World War II and the present, or because they watched loved ones go into the service and in some cases give their lives to this cause. You may have noticed that some of the people here today, some sitting up here, some sitting in the audience, are wearing name badges with a green border on them. Those are the folks who said yes when we asked if they were willing to be interviewed by a team of curious 12 and 13-year-olds. We are deeply indebted to those of you who agreed to be interviewed for this project, for without your stories, without your testimonies, we would not have a story to tell. It's your words, it's your voices, your stories and anecdotes that make oral history so captivating to listen to. It's your insights that make it so much easier for those of us who were not there to listen and to learn about and to learn from the past. So I'd like to ask right now each of our interviewees for this project if you would please stand so that we may acknowledge you. We're really very grateful to you and to your families and friends, your understudies and whatever else you call them, Jill Knappenberger, for joining us today. Each oral history project takes about 2 years from beginning to end. And the handful of students who conceive of the project and lead a team of peers through the entire process show exceptional commitment. They work for countless hours, year-round, and even continue for weeks after they've formally graduated from high school. In the process, they develop a really deep sense of ownership for the project. Tonight, we give special recognition to two young men who served as senior student producers of the Frontlines documentary, Leif Haig and Sanjay Koshi. Leif, would you please come forward? Leif's partner, Sanjay. Thank you. Leif's partner, Sanjay, is unable to be here this evening as he is in his first year at University of California, Berkeley. But Leif was able to put us on his itinerary in the midst of a very busy gap year before he goes on to college in Boston. And we're grateful to both Leif and Sanjay for your unerring commitment to this project and for the great integrity and respect for other people's lives and stories that you've shown throughout this process. You, both of you served for 4 years as WILL interns, and for me, working with you, it was absolute pleasure all the way along. So to each of you, we express our deep gratitude, and we offer, this is from the interns in me. Just a token of our appreciation, all right? And we hope that you'll take our warm wishes with you. Thank you. Many students contributed in various ways to the success of this project. If you were part of a team who, as subbies, interviewed one of our interviewees for this project, please stand up. Come on, don't be shy back there. Thank you. And if you helped produce the documentary, please stand also so that we may thank you for your participation. It has really been a pleasure to work with each of you, and we are all really proud of all the work that you guys have done. I would also like to thank a number of people who continue to support our partnership with WILL in many ways. We greatly appreciate the support of UNI's director, Dr. Jeff Walkington, of our associate director, Dr. Jeanette Knuckles, and of our director of advancement, Marianne Downey. All three are here this evening, and we, again, really appreciate your support of this partnership. We're also grateful to our IT guru, Matt Childress, to UNI's extraordinary librarian, Frances Harris, and to many UNI colleagues and parents who helped us make connections with people in the community who we otherwise might not have known. Finally, I'd like to thank the many members of the WILL staff, including Mike Pritchard, who came over here and got this all set up, Kimberly, who's been working really hard to pull this together, Jim Meadows, who's here, moderating our panel. Many, many people contributed to planning this meeting. Lisa Braltz Kelly, also over there, also was awesome at publicizing, and so it would not have happened without all of us. I am especially indebted to Dave Dickey and Kimberly Cronick for being so accommodating and generous in their support of this partnership. It's a pleasure to work with you as well. So thank you all for being here.
Okay, so thank you, Janet. And it's great to see everyone. We're going to do something unique now here in the history of this project, which is, in addition to thanking the people who participated and all the students who did all the work, we're going to take that work now and we're going to tee up a conversation. So what you're going to hear is a 7-minute segment from the documentary. And Leif, don't freak out. It's not the 10 minutes that occurred when it actually aired. What Jim did is he took a couple of stories, edited together into a new segment just for the purposes of this conversation. So you'll be like, "That we didn't do that." Right, we didn't. But it's for the purpose of this panel. So we're going to hear that 10-minute segment, and then we're going to have a conversation together. And that's what public TV and radio do all the time. We take great stories, and then we throw them out to the community, whether it's on radio, TV, or online, or in a conversation like this, and we continue the dialogue. And I'm so excited that your work can be part of this next dialogue, this next conversation. So I hope it's a good one. Feel free to ask questions. And Mike, if you would, let's hear that 7-minute segment.
When Pearl Harbor came along, I was at the movie. And all of a sudden, they shut down the movie, and everybody returned to the barracks. They didn't say why or nothing. But once you got outside, you knew something was going on. And we didn't know the war was on, you know, the Japanese had hit Pearl Harbor. And by the time we got back to the barracks, why, they were loading up the trucks and everything.
Though the U.S. government had already implemented a draft in response to German expansion in Europe, the number of draftees rose sharply after the Pearl Harbor attack. Over the next 3.5 years, 16 million men served in the military, 10 million of whom were draftees. Women were not drafted, but some did serve in the military, while others joined organizations like the Red Cross.
Every young man I knew was in the service, and everybody was 100% backing the United States in the World War II effort. So I wanted to be more active than my civil service job in Decatur. And I volunteered and went to Washington, D.C. in November 43 for a 2-week course with the Red Cross. I volunteered for Clubmobile, which was a request of Eisenhower. He wanted a mobile service to get out to the combat troops. They were equipped with donut machines. Donuts, incidentally, is the second most popular food that the GIs and service people wanted. First was hamburgers and then donuts next. We also had a phonograph on the Clubmobile with 78 RPM records in a PA system. And the minute we'd come up to some place to serve, we'd turn on the music. The guys just came from every place. And we danced to the records and served hot coffee and donuts.
Some military women served in the medical corps, and a few became pilots, though most were assigned clerical jobs.
Well, certainly they got the same pay and the same rank structure and all that. In World War II, women were enlisted primarily to free up males to fight in combat roles. So the women did not participate in combat roles. It was simply an emergency measure to free up men so that they could participate in combat roles.
During the Second World War, American military units were still segregated by race. One of the first African Americans to serve in the Marines recalls how the reality of military service turned out to be quite different from the promises of his recruiter.
He said, "Well, if you join the Marines, you'll receive the same training that all of the other Marines receive." I said, "Really?" He said, "Yes." I was too naive to ask other questions about would I be in the same camp, same companies, and all of that sort of thing. If I receive the same training, it must be in the same camp. Well, I just assumed that it would be if it were the same. My sameness wasn't the same as his, I discovered. It wasn't the training as such. It was the fact that it was separate from the main body of Marines, and I always felt that it was something second class about it, and I didn't think that since I had given up my civilian life, which was rather first class as I understood it at that time, to go into the Marines to serve my country with a second class status. That's a demotion, so to speak. It didn't make sense. I didn't understand why my country would want to do that to me.
Racism in the military was a reflection of the conditions and attitudes toward black people in the United States, especially in the Jim Crow South.
We were going through a place in Mississippi. The train stopped at, I think it was Tupelo, and there was a big sign, "Welcome, servicemen." The Red Cross was there with donuts, mountains of donuts and coffee urns. And we were like, oh boy, this is fine. We were going to be treated to coffee and donuts. We waited and waited and nothing happened. We expected our officers to tell us to fall out and go up the hill and get donuts and coffee. Nothing happened. Finally, a man came down the hill and walked along the track, sauntering and looking in. He didn't see anything but black faces. I think our white officers were hiding. I don't know where they were. The man went back up the hill and apparently told the women that only black Marines were on the train. And they closed the shop down. Forever after, I was angry with our officers for not saying, these are my men, they are servicemen, they're entitled to coffee and donuts at least. But they didn't do that. I didn't have much confidence or feel too kindly towards officers who were going to take me overseas and couldn't even face customs of the South. They didn't have the courage to do that.
Many wartime experiences left lasting memories. During the final months of World War II, the full horrors of the Holocaust came to light. As Allied troops penetrated deeper into German territory, they found Nazi concentration and extermination camps. These camps were used to confine and kill millions of people deemed undesirable, including Jews, Roma, homosexuals, and people with disabilities.
We also went to Buchenwald, which was near Weimar, the day after it was liberated, and there were bodies in the crematorium, some slave laborers, just like skin and bones there. And I did see the lamp shade that the commandant's wife had made from the skin of the prisoners. We saw the gas rooms, which were underground, and the commandant, he'd just walk over the top, and there was a little air hole, or he'd put the gas pellets down there and kill hundreds of people in these big rooms. They were told to strip, take all their clothes off, and put shoes here and stuff here and stuff here, that they were going to be deloused. That's what they were told. So here are all these men, women, and some children, all naked in these big, big rooms. They closed the doors, and then the commandant up above would walk along and just drop the cyanide tablets in there. And, of course, all these people just killed. Some of them put in mass graves, and you just couldn't believe that one human being would be so sadistic as to treat other human beings that way. But it was very horrible.
So those are just some of the voices in the work the students did. And again, you can hear the full documentary in the series at will.illinois.edu. Now we'll go into our discussion, A Changing Military, A Community Discussion. Moderating our panel is Jim Meadows. He's host of Focus on WILL, 10 to 11 a.m. Monday through Friday, and he's also our senior reporter, Jim Meadows.
Thank you very much. And I was wondering, in that segment we just heard, are any of the voices we heard present in the audience today? Okay, thank you very much for taking part. And I want to also thank our panel here for taking part, and let's say hello to them. Nicholas Osborne, on the far end from me, served in the Coast Guard and in Iraq and is now with the University of Illinois coordinating veterans programs over there. Richard Adkins served in the Marines in Vietnam. Evan Dankowitz worked on this documentary. He's currently a sophomore at Uni High School, and I believe the veteran he talked to is also in the audience as well. Paul Visvant. Yeah, the one looking, lifting his coffee cup. Yes, thank you very much. Jerry Young served at the Air National Guard in support of Operation Iraqi Freedom and Operation New Dawn, and she's right over there. And Eric Swenson here served in the Army in Iraq. He is not heard on the documentary. However, if you search around our website at will.illinois.edu. You'll hear a very fascinating interview that he gave to Chris Berube on our program, The Afternoon Magazine, earlier this year. We've just been listening to World War II veterans and people who were active during that war talking about their experiences. And one thing I wanted to ask you all, you may have already have heard, you know, tales from other World War II vets. How do you feel your experience compares? What's different and what's the same between World War II and your own wartime experience? Maybe if I can go to the far end of the table and ask Nick.
Thank you. Working with students and being a veteran myself, having served, I actually served with an Army intelligence unit. I was one of seven Coast Guard members over there at the time, so I got a lot of strange looks at my uniform. But what I find is that everybody's adjustment is different, and it's hard to sort of qualify what war means. I think it's something that we all experience differently, and there's a lot of factors that go into it. The veterans that I've met across the generations, there's definitely parts of their stories that I resonate with and that I relate to. And then there's other parts that are different. And I think that, for me, it just shows that there's a lot of complexity and there's a lot of emotion around this topic. And one of the best things that we can do as a society is to create as many conditions as we can that support returning service members, that give them benefits and give them access to services. And by doing so, create and inspire a collective healing.
Richard, now you served in Vietnam a different time than other people on this panel, but
yes.
can you tell me what was different then compared to World War II?
Well, actually, I reread All Quiet on the Western Front recently about World War I, and from perspective of a German soldier, and there was a lot of parallels. I connected with that character, with that soldier, on a lot of levels, suffering and suffering, and soldiers and Marines and those that are in a wartime situation are suffering, and so they have a lot of parallels. You know, I'm reading a book now, finishing up one that I would highly recommend, called Keeping Faith, about a relationship between a young man and his father. They co-wrote this book about Marine Corps boot camp and going into the Marine Corps serving. And, man, I had a lot of flashbacks reading this, the way his feet were about to rot off because of the punishment and the blisters, which I'm sure we can all relate to at some point from training. And those same things happened to soldiers in World War I and World War II. And so there's a lot of connections on a personal level for me. When it comes to talking about soldiers and being in a combat situation or combat zone, it's very, very powerful. It's just, they're all my brothers and sisters.
I wanted to ask you also, we heard about the difficulties of being an African-American in the military during World War II. Your experience in Vietnam 20 years later, what were things like?
There was still a lot of self-imposed segregation where black soldier Marines would stick together, the Hispanic Marines would stay together, and so on and so forth. It was a lot of that. You had to really reach out to cross those color lines to make connections and friends across the color lines. But, you know, at the time, It was the civil rights era was going on, and a lot of self-awareness for black men, black people. I was the first in my high school to wear afro. You know, it was kind of cool. I thought I was hot stuff until that Marine Corps barber shaved it off with three moves with the clippers. And it was the music, Runaway Child, Running Wild, The Temptations, and The Spinners, and you know, you guys have got to listen to that. Oh, he knows. You got to listen to that stuff, man. And that's what we had, that stuff blowing over loudspeakers, you know, over our bunkers out into the jungle. I think, you know, I could picture the VC out there just boogieing down. But, you know, that was the era, you know, it was youthful and exciting and scary. And I'd never been away from home before. I was from Kansas City. And I never even went across the river to Kansas City, Kansas. And then all of a sudden, at 17, I'm in the Marine Corps, and 18 in boot camp, and 19 in Vietnam. And that was the average age of soldiers serving in Vietnam, 19 years old. Teenagers with M16s.
That sounds like one common denominator, is that a lot of you came in with not much experience at anything until, yeah, boom, there you are.
I related it to going to another planet. I mean, the sun looked different. The moon looked different. Every living thing around you, you'd never seen before. It was like going to Mars for me. It was really, really an incredible experience.
Jerry Young, what was it like for you? And I confess, one thing I'm thinking of is the different roles that women were starting to play by the time you were in the military. Certainly in World War II and even in Vietnam, women's services were in clearly marked auxiliary branches, and that was gone by the time you came in.
Absolutely. That was one of the things I was going to mention, being the lone female up here representing womanhood. I would say that one of the bigger advantages that I had during my service was the expanding, you know, career opportunities, the opportunities for promotion that I'm eligible for now, especially with the victory we had in February, the repeal of the Combat Exclusion Policy, you know, taking career fields that were traditionally for men and allowing women to slowly over time integrate into those fields. Definitely one of the noticeable differences. And I would also say, coming from a mental health background, I work as a voc rehab counselor in mental health. One of the more noticeable differences I'd say over time would be the level of public awareness of the troops as they return home. It's not just you go overseas, you do your job, you come back home, and everything's normal. We're noticing that there are long-term effects, especially when you're at a war that's been going on for over a decade. We're only just now realizing some of the effects that we're going to have. You know, we don't know what's going to happen 10 years down the road or what the implications are going to be from that. So the level of public involvement, public awareness are bigger differences I've noticed.
Eric, and maybe that's something the jump on in World War II, well, certainly there was a draft as it was in the Vietnam era, but there's the feeling, at least looking back, that everybody was involved in this effort. Did you have that same feeling in your service?
Oh, boy, that's a really good question. But I will have to say that, strongly contrasting to some of the other experiences we've heard, right, the Army today is an all-volunteer Army. So everybody that's there is somebody who had the really brilliant idea of signing up and joining the military. And as you can imagine, that does actually create some divisions. I think one of the really powerful themes that ran through the whole program was the subject of race and how our experiences were also sharply different. I was in an infantry battalion as an intelligence analyst. And we deployed to Ramadi, Iraq from 2006 to 2007. But what really surprised me, actually, was that the vast, vast majority of all of the infantrymen in our battalion were white, and most of them were from rural communities. And I really strained my memory, and I actually can only remember one African-American infantryman that I ever met. And certainly that's just my own experience, and absolutely there were African-American infantrymen somewhere, but I didn't meet them. And there were infantrymen from other minority groups, a few men from Puerto Rico or from Mexico who had joined the infantry. All of the vast majority of the minorities and African Americans were in support companies who were attached to us. And actually, I think that created some problems and some tension. It was a mistake. It created kind of an us and them. And I was more close with the infantrymen, and I worked with them more closely. And there was always kind of grumbling, you know, like, why are we here? Why are we kicking down doors while these guys are kicking back and, you know, repairing Humvees or something? Which was kind of ugly, really, when you think about it. And some of that criticism was really unfair because, as we all know, you know, mechanics in the Army who did tours in Iraq and Afghanistan or who were truck drivers were all doing convoy duty, were all encountering IEDs or were dodging RPGs. And this almost voluntary segregation sort of led to that. On the other hand, I think that there was some of the criticism was kind of fair. If you were an infantryman, at least from my experience, the odds were very good that you were white. And if you were in a support unit, the odds were good that you were not white.
Richard, I'm wondering, you in the era when you were in the service in the Marines, the draft was in full force. You know, the common line that I
volunteered.
Heard. Yes, I did want to mention, you were not drafted yourself.
No.
When you enlisted, did you think, well, maybe I should do this and not wait to see if I'm drafted, or was it
no,
just...
No, there was no fear of the draft for me. It was a rite of passage. It was a way to grow up a little bit, challenge myself, and to get some independence from mom's apron strings. And it was an adventure. It was a little bit frightening. I had no idea, really, what the war was about or if I would even end up there. I should have known, but I didn't. And 10 months later, there I was in the jungles of Vietnam.
How were African Americans and minorities, if this is the right word, distributed through the armed forces in your experience?
Well, what I saw was a lot of poor and disenfranchised, it seemed to me, black, brown, yellow, and otherwise, that were on the front line, so to speak, on the were the foot soldiers. Those like myself that came from inner cities, broken homes. It seems to be a disproportionate number of that type of minority person out front, and those that had some political connections or some wealth or some contacts were not out front. And I think it's probably true in both Iraq and Afghanistan today, the same type of situation. It's sad, but that's what I saw. I saw a lot of throwaway kids, so to speak, in the Marine Corps trying to find themselves and trying to prove something to themselves or trying to find some self-worth and value. And it was a powerful experience for me. I really loved the Corps. I mean, I don't know how you can go through something like that and not love it. Although my mother was like a DI, she was like a drill instructor, so it wasn't quite that difficult for me. I knew how to make a bed, and I knew how to do certain things that the other guys just seemed to didn't know what to do with anything. And so I was just amazed that they were so helpless. You know, their moms had fed them with the spoon and silver spoon or whatever, and you know they'd never been hungry. They never had holy shoes and a you know thin coat in the wintertime. And so I was a little bit tougher than a lot of those guys that I went in with, and it was served me well. I mean, Marine Corps is about building killers. You know, that's what it's about. The truth be told, they're killers, and they protect us, you know, but they're devil dogs, no doubt about it.
Jerry, I wanted to ask you, it would have been a different situation, but how were women, you know, what positions were they put in? Did they have the freedom to get the positions they sought, given the restrictions on combat roles? Where did you usually see women on duty when you were serving?
When I was serving, the combat exclusion policy was still in place. So career fields that were designated as specific for the purpose of engaging in combat, women were not allowed to go into. So you saw a lot of women in administration roles, which has pretty much been consistent throughout our history of involvement in wars. But over time, the presence of women in maintainer roles, maintenance roles, has been growing, which those were traditionally more male-oriented career fields, but women were allowed to go into those as well. I will say something with the current conflicts going on. There's really no discernible front line. You know, you can be in the infantry. You can be a maintainer driving a truck. There's no set combat zone. I mean, everything's fair game, it seems like, over there. You know, you're driving down the road. You can't just say, I'm not, you know, in a combat career field. You can't do that. You're susceptible to that as well. So there's just no discernible front line there. So those distinctions kind of got blurred.
Mm-hmm. I was wondering, because, of course, everybody who comes back still brings all these memories and experiences with them. And one thing I was wondering is how the civilian world looks to everybody when they're back in it. Nicholas, maybe especially because you talk to a lot of veterans returning as students. What are their experiences that they're telling you?
Well, I think that coming back to school as a returning service member, there's the chronological age difference, but there's just basically the difference in life experience. When I do faculty and staff development, I tell them, I say, you know, you may have a 19 or 21-year-old veteran in your course, but this person may have been a team leader who was making life and death decisions. You know, I think that that's something World War II, Vietnam, Korea, in all conflicts that young people are put in positions that they're typically not put in the civilian society. So I think that that's one part, but I think that there's just this difference of culture from the acronyms, from the way that they walk into a room and assess if there's a threat or where they want to sit in a classroom environment. And I think that it's really important to share that type of information with civilians who work with veterans and who are around veterans to see that there is this difference in culture. And then ideally what we want to do, particularly at the university, is to give tools. And we've had a couple of discussion panels, which Jerry's actually been on in the past. And I think that by sharing a personal narrative, it helps to deconstruct assumptions. One thing that many veterans I work with are very sensitive to is this assumption that the returning Iraq and Afghanistan veterans are all, quote unquote, dangerous or crazy or are having readjustment issues. Again, I think that there's a lot of complexity in that. But we don't ever want to place them in a category where we see them exclusively as damaged. I think that we really want to look at the gifts, the leadership, the resourcefulness and the resilience that they bring.
Eric, what was your experience coming back? How did life look different?
Oh, boy. I think, you know, you go out of high school and you go into the military, any branch, you spend however many years in that, and you get out into the civilian world, just about everything looks different. I mean, I can't even tell you just on a really simple, fundamental level, I mean, people smell different, right? The sounds coming around you are different. The food tastes a lot better. and attitudes are different, and people treat you differently. And those are hard things to deal with. But I just, if I could really compel one point, it's not just that you're trying to interface in a new way. It's that just everything has become so totally different to you, just down to those really fine components.
When they said they treat you differently, did they treat you differently knowing you were a veteran?
I'm trying to think of a specific example. Coming to the university, I don't know if people really realized, classmates or instructors right off the bat, that I was in the military. At least if they did, people didn't say that. But it was just sort of like I was the one really old student in a class full of like 18-year-old kids. And then that's a challenge enough right there.
Mm-hmm. Richard, I was wondering, coming back during the Vietnam era, and, you know, I'm old enough to remember when a lot of dramatic TV shows at a certain point had their episode about the disturbed Vietnam veteran who committed some sort of terrible crime.
It was a common theme. And it was hard to find employment, I think, for a lot of us because of that. It was difficult for me to find a job 3 or 4 months after I got home.
You think being a veteran was a strike against you?
Well, I had grown so much. I couldn't wear any of the clothes that I had at home when I was in high school. So I had this camouflage jacket, Marine jacket, and I wore it around town to look for work. And when they saw that, it was like, no work here for you. Mm-hmm. So the first job I got was with the railroad as a switchman, which you're out in the weather all the time, and that sent me to college right away. That sent me to school. But, we were yelled at the airports. They were called baby killers, and I didn't wear my uniform when I got out to come home.
Did you meet people who had that experience?
Oh, I had that experience, mm-hmm. and I certainly met a lot of people that had that experience coming home, and, it was almost like you wanted to be proud of your service, but you were maybe a little bit ashamed of being in the military. It was a very conflicting feelings associated with that whole era.
Do you see different attitudes now?
Oh, absolutely. People love veterans and praise them and come up and say thank you for your service, and they ask about Vietnam and the time that I was there, which was 1969 to 1970. It was right after the 68 Tet Offensive, which was pretty hairy for a lot of people. And by 69, they expected the same kind of aggressive attacks, but it didn't happen, thank God. So, it was a crazy time. I didn't want to tell a lot of people that I was in the military. And, of course, by the time I got home from Vietnam, I'd let my hair grow a little bit so they couldn't tell right away that
the afro was back.
Not quite all the way back, but it wasn't the Marine Corps chili bowl haircut, which we're all familiar with.
Yeah. Evan, I'm sorry I haven't asked you anything, but I did want to ask you. You know, you took part in these interviews, and I've read some of the transcripts. You folks were asking people everything about their lives, it seems. Did you come in, had you had an opportunity to talk with veterans, maybe in your own family or friends, about their experience, or was this all new to you?
This was mostly new to me. I learned a lot through the whole process of doing the interviews, and after doing the interviews, simply looking at the transcripts of the other interviews and putting them together into a documentary, learning as I was sharing, you could say.
What were some of the things most striking to you that you did not expect to find out?
Well, one thing that was just unexpected was a lot of the anecdotes. We ended up looking at a lot of the interviewees would ask people questions. We would often get stories back and interesting stories back, and so it was often very surprising just to hear the situations that the people were in. They're in the some of the, in culture in popular culture. You often hear about some of these the issues that we recovered, but some of the situations that people are put in are often not as well known. So that was
Okay. Thank you very much. I was wondering. We haven't heard anything from the audience at this point, but if anybody has a brief question for a panelist, Kimberly is ready to scamper around with the mic if you just want to raise your hand.
I know some of you guys up in the panel. Richard, I was up in the air bombing you when you were on the ground. My military career spent from 1967 till I retired in 2009. So it was a long time. It was Vietnam, Desert Storm, a whole bunch of other stuff, helped write the invasion plans for Operation Iraqi Freedom. I think one thing that comes back, and Richard and I, I can relate this from Vietnam and the same thing from Iraq. When you guys enlisted or you were mobilized and get ready to deploy, what was your understanding of the reason why we were activated and sent to war and given the orders to kill and destroy and everything that we did do?
You want me to go first?
Yeah.
Well, it's kind of cliche now. We were told that we were going to protect the Vietnamese people from communism, the communist threat, and that they wanted us to be there in their country, which they didn't act like they wanted us to be there after I got there. But that's what we were told. And so, you know, we like the generations before us, every male in my family had served in the war, had uncles in Korea, had a brother in Korea, had men in my family served in World War II. My father was in the Navy. I still haven't forgiven him for it. So it was like I said, for me, it was kind of a rite of passage, a way to grow up and to take a burden off my poor working mom, because my brother and I were eating everything in the apartment. So she only had one to worry about after I left. So
I appreciate the honesty of your question, by the way. I think it cuts right to it. I'm a Northern California native, and my parents were in Berkeley in the 60s. So when I said I'm going in the military, they said, what the hell did we do wrong? So, you know, for me, I was a junior officer at the time, and I had about, 45 or 50 people that I supervised. And in my personal life, I do meditation, and I shop at the co-op and this and that. So just from a moral issue, those questions popped in my mind. And I personally didn't look at the larger context of why are we over here, what's precipitated all this, and sort of what's behind the curtain. What I did is I made my mission solely my guys. And so that really is what consumed my year-long deployment over there, was really taking it day-to-day and taking care of the people that I was entrusted to protect. And that really, in many ways, sort of transcended the larger political reasons.
Yeah. Being a guardsman, my experience was a little bit different because I work in a combat operations squadron. So there's a distinct division between the maintainers and the operations guys, like he was talking about earlier. Our operations guys are out the door constantly. It's a revolving door for them. The maintainers don't really go anywhere that often. So I felt like I've been in the service for 6 years. I've never gone anywhere. And, you know, what have I been training for? So I actually got to volunteer. I volunteered for a deployment. I got with our unit deployment manager. I saw what was coming down. I said, I want to go on this one. So I feel like my decision was very informed. I went over there for the drawdown out of Iraq. That's what I did. So it was really straightforward, but I think I just had that experience because I did get to volunteer to go. Otherwise, I don't know if they would have taken me.
Well, I enlisted into the Army in 2005, and so by the time I got into it, the war had already started. And I've tried to piece all this back together in retrospect, and I do remember there were a lot of different voices at that time. We were a couple years into the wars, and so there were people dissenting. There were a lot of people saying what we were doing was wrong. There were still a lot of people saying what we were doing was right. And in the end, I made a really personal decision. I did believe in our mission, and certainly I don't think anyone can argue and say that Saddam Hussein was a good guy that should still be in power today. And I believed in that. But at the end of the day, I made a decision I felt was right for me. And those kinds of those parts of my thought process were more peripheral, I think. So maybe I was ignorant or naive or I don't know. But that's how I went in.
Do we have any other questions? Right there.
Thank you. The relationship of the country with the war has been very different from World War II to Vietnam. So there was a lot of passion in those two wars, favorably, and with Vietnam like turning very passionately negative. In the more recent wars, it seems like there is a certain indifference, and probably, you know, part of the reason people can be nice is because it's not really affecting anyone's, or not a lot of people's lives, you know. The servicemen are doing their stuff there, and we're here. But my question is this, so do people who are in the war, do you talk about the way the country reacts to the war during the time that you're there? I mean, is that a factor in your mind, or, you know? Anyway.
That's a great question. A really good friend of mine and I were talking about this not too long ago, and, you know, once you get boots on the ground and you're in another country and you're just so wholly removed from the United States of America, and so this friend of mine was telling me that in their TOC, which is like a, there's an acronym for you, but that was like a operating command center at a higher level that would develop plans or give down orders and things like that. Anyway, that's where all the planning happened. And on the wall, when you walked in, the first thing you saw was they had put up a piece of paper and printed on it that said, oh boy, I got to get this exactly right. It said, it said, the army is at war. America is shopping at the mall.
I think some of that indifference, too, comes from the fact that we are an all-volunteer force now. In terms of the number of people serving in the military, I believe we're less than 1%. Is it one? We're less than 1%. So sometimes you're hard-pressed to find individuals that even know a member that's currently serving or recently served in the military, which makes it easier to remove yourself or not have an investment in that issue.
I taught fourth grade for a short time in 2005 or six when you were in the military, and I was really trying to build a connection with my students and those that served in the military, and so we had projects, we had posters. I had a Marine Corps captain, a friend of mine, come and speak to the class, and really trying to make this connection. And it seemed to be really opposed by the administration at the school, that they didn't want the kids to think about or talk about our servicemen and women. And many of these children had family members that had been in the service or were presently in the service. It was an odd feeling for me to be kind of shunned by everybody moving around and ignoring what was happening. And they, at that time, were not seeing the young men and young women coming back with missing limbs and brain injuries and all the things that we are seeing a little bit more of today at that time. And it just seemed really odd to me, really offensive to me, that I was kind of looked down upon for promoting this connection between the students that I had and servicemen and women at that time, serving in Iraq and serving in Afghanistan. It's still kind of odd and bizarre to me that people would not want their children to know the sacrifices being made.
And do you think that, did that have anything to do with the war perhaps becoming, that particular conflict perhaps becoming more unpopular at the time, or was this a more long-term sentiment that you got from
the military? I'm not really sure. I know during Vietnam, it was a lot of combat on TV. I mean, you could see Vietnam. It was the first war that was televised. I mean, you could almost recognize some of the soldiers from your neighborhood there. It was real personal because you could see the blood and you could see the suffering. And this Iraqi-Afghanistan thing seemed to be so sanitized. There was nothing on TV. It was like a movie. I don't think anybody really took it seriously. What was happening there and what's happened since? I don't know. I don't know what the disconnect was. But I was really ashamed of the administration there at the school for their stance on that.
Nick, what do you see at the college level in terms of awareness and feelings between with students who don't have that military connection and veterans?
That's a great question. Going back to my earlier comment about culture, I do focus groups with incoming veterans every semester, and I ask them, I say, so what are your initial concerns? And it's always the quote-unquote the liberal progressive, therefore anti-military university. And then when I get with the faculty and staff, and as Jerry mentioned, that since 9/11 we have less than 1% of Americans who have served in the military. So there's a lot of questions about post-traumatic stress and traumatic brain injury and potential for violence and things like that. So what I find is that we have these opposing groups, and then we have the civilian students who fall somewhere in the middle. And most of my veterans have articulated to me that they don't like to be outed in class. So being a veteran is something that they want to share on their own terms and in their own time. And that's something that I always want to pass on to faculty, to don't out any of your students about anything unless you clear that first. And I think that there is, for some students, I don't want to say all student veterans, but I think that they look at a lot of our students as very sheltered and a bit naive and maybe a little overly optimistic about the way parts of the world operate. And again, I don't want to make any sort of large generalizations and say student veterans all think this way, but these are definitely anecdotes and themes that pop up in my work.
Just to piggyback real quick, when you mentioned being outed by professors, one of the things that happened most frequently in my classroom experience is the professors that I had that knew that I was a veteran. Anytime something major happened with the military on TV or there was some big news event, I immediately became the spokesperson for the military. It was like, oh, what do you think about what's going on? Or can you explain what happened here? And something like that, you can't possibly know that, but people were turning to you for answers, and it was really uncomfortable when that happened.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we have a question here. Great.
Well, actually, it's not a question. I come from Kansas City, where someone else comes from. My experience is probably a little different because I was ROTC in high school from day one until I graduated. Uncles were all military. My father, was a minister and definitely not in favor. But you have to also understand that we were the era where we had bomb shelters in schools, where we had drills, we had the C rations in school from grade school until graduation. So our viewpoint of the military was totally different. And I joined the military because I turned down some other offers and my scholarships disappeared. But I ended up having some experiences in some unique places and was fortunate to attend West Point. And at that time, they would post all the dead graduates from West Point as you walked into the mess hall, and you could see the difference in the volunteers, those that had been in the military that then entered West Point versus those that got an appointment straight from school. I got my appointment while I was in the military. I guess I'm saying that to try to take and put the same kind of values on a nation that no longer had that base of experiences where the whole nation at one time was ours is not the reason why ours is but to do or die. That was the philosophy when I came out, which was different because I'm a little older than Richard. But once I got out, I still remember being in a college class in my fatigue, and I watched my grade, and I made a decision to cut my hair, shave my goatee, and never wear my fatigues in class again. And I still remember the instructor saying, I see I've made an impression, and now I learned one other thing. I never talked about the military or my experiences from that day on, and my grade went up. So the type of response that came from the community to individuals coming back during that Vietnam period, and mine was, once again, before yours, was totally different. I was very fortunate in that some of my training was done with some of the individuals that were great athletes, which was totally different. But as far as segregation, that was a part of life. But I also remember drill instructors from Korea that you knew if it didn't matter whether it was man, woman, or child, you have what you call a kill zone. And if anything's in the kill zone, that's what it's designed for. You know, and they had the scars to show what happened if you did not do that. One was being scalped by some kids that he had given candy to. And if his partners hadn't come up, he would have basically died. And so that's just one story. But at that time, that was just a way of life. And so going in at that period of time, with those type of instructors, your job was to kill. And it left a mark on you when you came out, and most of the returning vets were not individuals that smiled a lot or talked very much. And once you were identified, you did all you could not to be identified anymore.
Well, I'm glad all of you have stood up to talk for this documentary and with us this evening. We're getting close to our curfew time, and I just wanted to see if I could talk to all of you for just a little final statement, if you want to react to what our speaker just said, or if you had any other thoughts of your own.
Jim, can we get one more in?
Certainly.
Thank you.
Thank you. If for no other reason, you should give over to age. I'm the oldest person here, I'm sure. 90. It's. what is this? I should like to take a more personal note, if I may. I want to thank Ms. Morford and the students at University High for allowing me to unburden my interview with the students. Of course, it was difficult at first getting started, but I discovered that it was part of the therapy that I needed. I learned soon after I got into the Marines that I had been deceived. I thought I was going to be a first-class Marine, and I ended up, in every sense of the word, a second-class Marine, intentionally. It was ordained from the commandant on down that I should be. And I wondered why I was taken out of the marvelous life of Boston to go into such a thing to fight for my country. And I became rather bitter inside. I controlled it, but I must confess that there was bitterness. And bitterness often hurts oneself more than it does anybody else. And so I appreciate very much an opportunity to talk to you. You'll never know how much good you've done this old Marine. And you helped me to be more gracious thereafter when talking about my life in the military. I just want to add one other note, because I don't think this had happened when I talked to the students at University High. Sometime after my interview with you, the Congress of the United States of America bestowed upon me and those Marines who suffered in ways that my friend Richard did not. And I'm pleased that you did not have to. You suffered in other ways, though. The Congress bestowed upon those pioneers in the Marine, black pioneers in the Marine Corps, the Congressional Medal of Honor. At long last, there was some recognition of the wrong that the Marines had perpetrated and the hurt that we had suffered. And it was good that the country took or made some effort to make amends, or in a way of speaking, to apologize. So I'm better off for all of you. And I thank you very much.
Sir, thank you. If I can go back to our panel for some final words. Nick, do you have anything to say?
Well, after that, I just want to say thank you to everybody in this room and to the students for putting this together. My closing comments, I don't really have any closing comments other than one thing that's really interesting about this war, aside from its duration, is that the reliance we have on what we used to call weekend warriors. So we have a lot of multiple deployments now. And I think that that also brings in a whole other layer of stress, particularly those who leave the military, but they're still obligated, possibly, if they get activated. It's kind of like a black cloud that follows them until they're officially out. And, you know, I work with students on a daily basis. I hear a lot of different stories. Some are absolutely heart-wrenching, and some are just funny as all hell. Yeah, so it really runs the gamut. Veterans Day was a tough day for some of my students. But I just think it's, you know, it's something that I believe that war is a commitment that goes to all of us, civilian and service member alike, and that we all serve our country in its own capacity. And my closing comment is that aside where people fall politically on the war, I would say without a doubt that the country has been providing so much for our service members. And every day I get phone calls and emails from people who are just saying, what can we do to help? How can we assist here? So I want to leave it on that positive note. And thank you again for your time.
I just recently became a member of the Agent Orange Registry because of my time in Vietnam. And I happened to be at Camp Lejeune after the war for several months.
And some of you may not have known that there was some toxic substances, or water.
Chloroethylene.
I can't say that word. Thank you. poisoned a lot of Marines that had come back from Vietnam. They survived Vietnam, and then they got poisoned there at Camp Lejeune, and there were birth defects and miscarriages and a lot of horrible things that their families had to endure, the ones that had wives and children there on the base. When you see someone that has served, just be kind and just be loving and just encourage them and support them any way you can. Thank you for allowing me to be here today.
Evan, I'm wondering, you know, with all the work you've done and all the voices and stories you've listened to working on this documentary, and maybe more you've heard from people since then, simply because things have been triggered by your work. Do you have any reflections or things that you've learned that you didn't know a couple of years ago?
Well, as I was sort of saying earlier, this similar documentary and hearing from all these people gives you a perspective that you don't get from, say, reading a history textbook or something. It's real people, you know, real thoughts, and suddenly these issues are tied to real events, and it's just much more meaningful that way.
Well, thank you for working on it. And Jerry, any words?
Just wanted to say thank you. This has been a wonderful opportunity, and seeing how the project started 2 years ago and then to finally hearing it recently, it's been a wonderful experience, and you guys have all done a great job. And just, you know, thank you for the continued support.
Eric?
Bitterness maybe is something that I think we might all share. People ask me all the time, what can we do for our veterans? What's the one thing that veterans need? And that is such a hard question to answer. There are a lot of people doing good work. There are a lot of good programs helping veterans. And I reflected on this question a lot. And it took me a long time to come up with an answer. And surprisingly, it came from people thanking me for my service. People said, thank you. And for some reason, that felt wrong to me. That felt disingenuous somehow. And I couldn't figure out why. And what I came to realize was that thank you is an ending. When someone says thank you, it's for something you've already done and is over. I'm finished with the military, and I never want to go back to that. That part of my life is over. But I think for myself and for many other veterans, we still can serve you. We can still serve this country. We still have something to offer. And I think if there's one thing that you can do for veterans, it's that you should ask us to do more for you.
Well, thank you very much. I hesitate to say those words now. But I wanted to thank all of you for being on the panel today, and all of you who came to attend. Maybe the best words for veterans, instead of just saying thank you for your services, we're very glad to have you with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.